Welcome to the Untribal Podcast, the show that gives you news content by regular people for regular people. Today I'm joined by the lassie who swapped Hong Kong for Dumbarton, the big city lights for that big rock everyone talks about, the South China Sea for the River Clyde, and it's been 2 years since she made her first Untribal Podcast appearance, and her name has changed a little slightly. Across the globe, she conquered one of the highest honours of the land, Dame Commander of the Order of the British Empire, Jackie Bailey. Ladies and gents, how are you doing today, Jackie? You all right?
My goodness, what an introduction. Yeah, I'm great, thank you.
Let's talk about that first, Jackie. What was that like? How was the ceremony? Oh,
it was a surprise, a shock. I think that would be accurate to say. You don't come into politics expecting this kind of thing. But of course, I'm deeply humbled by the honour that was bestowed. But you know, this isn't about me. This is very much about my constituents, because we campaign together, we fight for things together. And it's equally probably a bit about the Parliament turning 25 years old, which is quite an achievement for what is a very new institution to become so embedded in the nation's consciousness. So I think it's for all of those things, but absolutely surprised.
Very modest, Jackie, very modest.
I always have been.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've been in the Parliament a long time, and to have that kind of recognition must be nice, though.
Oh, I mean, it's great. You don't go into politics expecting it. Genuinely, you don't. So it came as a bit of a surprise and a shock. But, you know, it's for my constituents. It's for the Parliament. And I think there are going to be celebrations later this year planned to mark the 25th anniversary of the Parliament. My only regret is I think it could do so much more than it has currently done. But that's maybe a topic for the future.
Maybe in the next 10 minutes or so, Jackie, who knows? But listen, Jack, I've never been a royalist myself, right? It's just something about royalism that doesn't sit right with me. Now, I thought about this when, you know, especially with yourself having been on the Untribal Podcast before, and I seen you got your dame hooped, and I was delighted for you. And I thought to myself, you know, would I accept such an honour, you know, with my values being so diametrically opposite to what royalism stands for? And to be fair, the only thing that stopped me was that, you know, I find it hard to complain about when there's not enough head in my pint of Tennent's, for example. You know, imagine turning down a knighthood or a damehood. You know, imagine standing in between Lewis Hamilton and Beth Mead, be like, no, I'm actually all right, Charles. I'm good, actually. You know, I did turn it down ever cross your mind? You know, a lot of people look at Labour representatives with a party with such history and socialism and think, you know, does that align with their values? Did turn it down ever cross your mind?
There was a debate with my daughter about it, but it didn't last that
interesting.
Long.
Interesting, okay.
Absolutely. But, you know, when the suggestion was made that it was a nomination from constituents as well, then you would be very foolish to turn something like that down. Sure, and I said, if this was about me, I could absolutely understand that view about, you know, whether you would buy into something like this or not. But the reality is, I don't think it was about me. It was about what I stood for. And that's about representing your constituents. That's about, you know, giving your all in Parliament, whether you're in government or indeed in opposition. I have to say, I was delighted that it was the Princess Royal that actually did the ceremony. I have the hugest regard for her because she's a hard worker and full of common sense. So, you know, that bit of it was certainly a delight. And my family came over from America because my brother's out there, and they came over to be part of the ceremony. So it was lovely.
So a special moment, yeah, for the family. Yeah, and that, yeah, of course. Was. So how is Dumbarton, Jackie? Tell us what you've been up to since we last seen you.
Well, Dumbarton's sunny. The sun is shining today, as it always does in Dumbarton. You know, so things are good here. People are still struggling with the cost of living crisis. So a lot of that is something I see in my caseload. But the thing that is the most challenging at the moment is housing. There is a housing emergency going on.
Right.
And I have people who are on the housing waiting list in Western Bartonshire. The council and local housing associations are doing their utmost to help people. But the reality is there are not enough houses. The building programme has slowed. Homelessness is on the increase. And there are, as we know, across the nation, more and more children in temporary accommodation because they're homeless. I think the latest figure is something like 10,000. So you know, in that context, for the government to cut its housing budget, which means, I think it was £200 million, the supply and building of new housing is going to wither on the vine. That's atrocious. We have an emergency. We need to do something about it. And that's coming through in my constituency postbag from constituents in Dumbarton.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that because, you know, I always, before Hamza came into office, I always thought, you know, when we think about Nicola Sturgeon and her legacy in Parliament, I always thought one of the things she did get right was addressing child poverty. And I think the numbers did stack up against that, to be fair to her. Do you think that moves like that are going back on some of the positive things of Nicola Sturgeon's campaign under Hamza's reign?
Well, I think it's not just going back. I think they've got it wrong. So, you know, there's no doubt that people appreciate the Scottish Child Payment. But it's not just about money alone. It's about environment. It's about opportunity. So housing matters alongside income. Education matters alongside income. You need to take a holistic approach. And certainly when we were in government, right at the beginning of the Scottish Parliament, we ended up lifting 200,000 children out of poverty in Scotland because we took that holistic approach. You can't do one thing and not pull the other levers at your disposal. And I think it was the chief executive of Shelter said, you know, you don't really care much about tackling children's poverty if what you're doing is leaving them in temporary accommodation, which is not suitable for their needs.
Do you not think, though, that we've been tight on in other departments, like the health service, for example, that's needed extra funds to pay the doctors more, for example? Where would you find the money, Jackie?
Well, I don't, as you would expect, resent or regret in any way paying health staff what they're worth, because, you know, they are the backbone of the NHS. Without them, we wouldn't have a service. But the lack of planning and the raiding of other budgets in order to do that is financially incompetent. And my fear is we have, as a result of that, left other areas short. Now, with housing, they should be looking at doing things differently, working with the private sector alongside housing associations to make sure that we're increasing the budget. But, you know, it's not about just housing, because if you don't live in a warm, dry home, if your accommodation is insecure, evidence suggests that you will end up using the health service more than if you had permanent accommodation. So as a preventative measure, it makes sense to invest in housing, because then you save yourself money upstream. But I have to say, across the board in this budget, I can't make sense of what the SNP decisions have been. Because when I look at some of them, like cutting the fuel insecurity fund, as an example, key cost of living measure that we welcomed is now not there anymore. And yet people are still struggling with really high bills. And you take that from there right the way across to the cuts to the housing budget, and you see the scale of the decline in public services that I've not witnessed for a very long time.
But they would say we've had a lot of other pressures, like inflation, for example, has been really high over the past year. You know, we've not had any other help from the UK government. We can't borrow any more money. You know, again, I go back to, where would the money come from? We have to make cuts somewhere.
I absolutely accept that. But for 17 years, you don't just spend year on year. You plan for the times where, you know, it is raining and you need to have extra money, you know, tucked away to make sure that you can survive these periods. So for 17 years, I would say there's been very little financial planning for occasions like this. But in addition to that, you know, having been around for the full 25 years of the Parliament, I've seen the waste that is created, the nation building, the creation of agencies that actually aren't really needed at cost of millions and millions of pounds. And I'll give you an example. When I sat on the Economy Committee, the government brought forward a proposition to create Consumer Scotland, a new body, because consumer advice was being devolved to the Parliament. And yet we have an existing network of citizens' advice bureaus that already provide consumer advice that could have, for a much smaller sum of money, provided a gold standard service. And yet we didn't do that. We went for the more expensive option. So there are things like that where I just think there is considerable waste that could be repurposed and actually put back into frontline services. The government has not looked at that with any degree of seriousness.
One of your flagship criticisms of the handling for the health service, for example, is the amount of bodies that are currently running the health service, and that's what you would do to sort of streamline funding and make the NHS more efficient. But this brings us quite nicely to our social media questions, because we had one that said, in Moray West, near in Strathspey, we have local health services moved centrally to Inverness and Aberdeen in among the cutbacks. This has meant that, for example, a pregnant woman could have to travel over an hour on the A96 in Moray to give birth. There are no mental health support workers at any GP services in Moray. GP surgeries at Burghead and Hopeman have been closed, meaning locals need to get to two buses to travel to a GP. Why then is Jackie pushing for the health boards in Scotland to be cut from 6 to 3, which will result in further centralisation and priority lowered for rural services like in my area?
Great question. And let me set out what we're doing and why. And I hope that begins to answer that person's question. We actually currently have 14 territorial health boards, 8 special boards, 3 planning partnerships, 32 health and social care partnerships. We have a plethora of boards to serve a population of 5 million. There's just too many of them. And when I ask people in my area and indeed across Scotland what they care about, they care about, as your caller said, they care about services. They care about where their health centre is, where their hospital is. Nobody ever says to me they care about where their headquarters are, because frankly, that's not how they relate to the NHS. Now, we already have these structures that tend to exist around about secondary care, acute care, more than they do about primary care. And I want to rebalance the system. I think acute care, aside from the problems at the front door of A&E, actually does work very well. We have a range of specialisms across the board located in different areas of Scotland. But what we don't have is enough primary care services, enough GPs, enough dentists, enough health visitors, all the services that we should absolutely expect to be delivered locally are simply not there. In fact, GPs are reducing in number, and they've got more patients to deal with. So you have a perfect storm there. Now, for most people, we don't want them to have contact with acute services until they absolutely need to. You know, so the older you are more likely to encounter secondary services, but that usually is later in life. The key to that is making sure that people have local services so that that person actually has services in their community. But it's a balance. It's a balance between what you provide locally and the specialist services you should provide at the centre. At the moment, we don't have enough staff. The NHS is carrying something like 6,000 vacancies, and 14% of consultants' posts are vacant, the last set of statistics that I saw. So, you know, we've got a real critical problem with staffing. Now, all of these administrators who do an excellent job, they're sitting at health board level. I want to push them down into primary care, because if we're investing, then we're investing in local services. So it's the complete opposite of centralization. I actually want to push the people and therefore the emphasis on services down to a local level, because that's where we make the difference. Yeah, let me give you an example. I had somebody in the constituency who struggled to get a GP appointment, ended up trying to go to out of hours, went to out of hours, wasn't satisfied, self-presented at A&E. Now, you know, they didn't need to be at A&E, but had they engaged with the system because they were able to, because it was properly resourced earlier, you would again save money in the acute sector by making sure it's available in primary care. So quite the opposite. I want to decentralise, not centralise. I believe in, you know, local services and bottom-up approaches.
Do you not think an efficient way of growing the population and therefore addressing concerns about staff would be tailoring immigration policy so that more people are coming to Scotland? And if so, how would you change immigration policy at UK level in order to do so?
Well, already immigration is linked to skills gaps. I want to increase the opportunity for that. And that is equally as much about what we put into the system so that people understand our labour market challenges, where the skills gaps are, exactly who we're looking for and what jobs. and design a system that enables us to do that. I'm very conscious we have lots of people working in our NHS from abroad, and I welcome that. But alongside that, I want to also grow our homegrown talent, because at the end of the day, you know, if we're taking people from abroad, we're taking them away from their health systems in their own countries. So it needs to be a balance. But I have no problem with making sure that the immigration system responds to skills gaps. And it's up to us to identify those to make sure that we have the right approach to ensuring that people come, you know, to work in our NHS, to work in social care, indeed to work in other sectors as well.
So I've got a couple of questions from a Labour member. One of which is, how do you deal with disagreements between Scottish Labour and UK Labour, and how easy / difficult is it to be a separate entity?
To be honest, we actually don't have very many disagreements, and when we do, they're resolved quickly. And genuinely, personal relationships matter. You know, nobody who looks at the, you know, body language or personal relationship between Anas Sawar and Keir Starmer is in any doubt that these two get on. And that helps enormously in talking about policy and talking about differences in approach. And we are very respectful of each other. You know, I've had discussions with colleagues at a UK level. They've had discussions with me, as you would expect. Sometimes they've been more robust than other times. But because we like each other, it really helps enormously to make sure we get to the same place. And actually, people care about the same things. You know, whether you are a member of UK Labour or Scottish Labour, the reality is you care about tackling the cost of living crisis. You care about, you know, economic opportunity for people. You care about fairness and justice. Those values are the same, whether you're in Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, or indeed in England. And those are values that Labour members share across the country. But yeah, I mean, we've never been shy at saying what we think. And that will continue under the leadership of Anas Sawar, with me as his deputy.
So I'm going to press you slightly, Jackie, if you don't mind, because I think you talk about how there's not that many differences in outlook. I will press you on that a little bit, because socially, the big question of the past few years is how we view gender, and Scottish Labour were wholeheartedly behind the self-ID bill when it first came out. We talk about economically, Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves are talking about deregulating financial services and removing the cap of bankers' bonuses. On foreign policy, the position of Scottish Labour has been very different to that of the UK Labour. So you're downplaying the disagreements, but you have to admit there has been quite a few in recent years.
But you know, it's like a family. Not everybody in the family agrees with each other, but you come together as a family at the end of the day, you know, and you've highlighted all these things. I mean, I could have said to you, there's this and there's this and there's that. But actually, we will continue to work really hard to make sure that Scottish Labour's view is heard. And the election, well, the one thing we do know is this year there is going to be a general election, is a real opportunity to send Scottish Labour MPs down to be a key influence in the heart of what I hope is a new UK Labour government. So I view all of this as an opportunity, a continuing conversation. It's not something I fall out about and run off with, you know, upset about it. I just redouble my efforts because I think we're right. And therefore, we will work with our colleagues to make sure that that view holds sway.
Okay. Well, you're after the same votes, to be fair, so you have to agree at some point. So the second question was, is it possible to get young people as enthused with Labour in Scotland as many have been with the SNP? That was from a Labour member as well.
I think it comes in cycles, to be honest with you. You know, I've seen, you know, back in the day, lots of enthusiastic young people, myself included, thinking that the only solution to this was to vote Labour. And I grew up at a time where Thatcher dominated politics. But I'm starting to see that now. And you know what's fascinating is when you spend most of your life on people's doorsteps, you get to engage in really interesting conversations. So just this weekend, I met a first-time voter. Who genuinely was confused about, you know, whether he should vote Labour or vote SNP. He clearly wasn't voting Tory, but recognised that, for example, in his case, his mother was on an NHS waiting list, and he felt actually let down by the SNP in government, and recognise that Labour offered to do things differently. So there are people making their minds up across the country. The other thing I've noticed is there's a lot more young people wanting to do internships in the parliament, to come and work in my office, and that hasn't been the case before. So I think as the rest of the country is saying, actually, we've had enough of two governments that have failed us, both the Tories for 14 years at Westminster and the SNP for 17 years at Holyrood, they are reacting to that and saying, look, it is time for a change. We are going to give Labour a chance. We feel enthused by the leadership, certainly of Anas Sawar in Scotland. They want to be part of that change, and I welcome it.
Do you think if Labour were open to the idea of having a referendum on independence, they would be in for a landslide victory at the next election?
To be honest, we've always been clear that, that's not our position, and we've been very upfront about it. But, you know, poll after poll tells us that actually that's not the position that the majority of Scottish people hold just now, because there are far more important things for them. You know, the cost of living crisis being something I've mentioned already, you know, jobs and the economy, the state of the NHS, all of these issues rank much higher than the question of a second independence referendum. And we're not the party that will deliver that, given our stance on it. But if you look at the SNP, the SNP are disappointing their own supporters because there is no route under them to a second independence referendum. I think they've changed their position as to how to get it at least four, five, six times in my reckoning. And people that I meet again on the doorstep are disappointed, and are considering for the first time giving their vote to Labour, because we will get to the kind of society they want quicker than any route to independence. And they're recognising that. And I'm pleased, because it's an opportunity to boot the Tories out of number 10, but it's an opportunity to actually vote for the kind of society that I want to live in, that I know my constituents want to live in, that's characterised by fairness.
That actually brings us nicely to our next question. Does Dame Bailey agree that the authorisation of a referendum on Scottish independence is a question for the Scottish people and therefore the Scottish Parliament, and not Westminster, where only 9% of representatives are elected in Scotland, and not the UK government, which a pro-independence has no conceivable chance of forming? If not, why?
I have always believed in the sovereignty of the Scottish people. I mean, it's been a long-held belief. When I first started arguing for a Scottish Parliament, it was because of that very issue. So, you know, I'm consistent on it. At the end of the day, though, it is a huge decision for any country to take. There's no going back. I don't think we've been well served by the lack of information, or, to be frank, some of the fanciful information that has been provided to people. And as I said before, you know, the people I meet who believe in independence are saying to me, not now. We have far more serious issues to be getting on with. You know, I met a family the other day. They were worried about the education of their child. That's wholly devolved. We're in charge of that already. You know, the same with the NHS. In so many areas of Scottish life, the Scottish Parliament is already in charge of what goes on, and I'm not sure we're making the best of it that we possibly could.
You said something interesting there, no going back. Is that a hint at Labour's Brexit position for the future?
No, I mean, we've been very clear. Brexit is done. It wasn't what we wanted. I certainly campaigned against Brexit, and I campaigned in a constituency where I didn't see any SNP members out campaigning alongside me. And my memory seems to suggest, what was the by-election? Was it Shetland? There was a by-election? Orkney? I think it was Shetland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so, yeah.
And I think the SNP spent more on that by-election than they did in the whole of the Brexit campaign. So they've jumped on this issue to make it theirs, but they weren't there when we were all campaigning on the streets to remain in the European Union. But let me be positive. Let me put that to one side. I am half Portuguese and half Scottish. I believe in a European Union. I know that Keir Starmer is saying that he wants to make sure we have a much closer working relationship with the EU. And for me, that will do just now. You know, I'm not saying that I will never argue to be part of the EU, but that's maybe an argument for another day. We have pressing problems like the state of the NHS that deserve all of our attention to resolve.
And just our last question from our listeners was, ask her about the Welsh Labour Party's WhatsApp message deletions and who should be sacked.
Okay, I have
very
no
direct.
Idea. I have no idea about the Welsh Labour Party's WhatsApps, but I operate on the basis of transparency. That's a key principle, and I think that should apply to every elected representative. I am clear that anybody deleting WhatsApp messages that were pertinent to the pandemic should not have done so. And obviously that's a deflection from the fact that Nicola Sturgeon deleted all of her WhatsApp messages. And whilst I as a politician may regard that, you know, as wholly wrong, I think the view coming from the COVID bereaved families is the one that I took to heart when they said that they trusted her every day standing up, delivering information about the pandemic. They trusted her, and now they feel so let down because she's hidden information that they wanted to know about. But for me as a politician as well, it is about that piece of learning for the future. This isn't going to be the last pandemic we have. There are going to be others. We need to understand how decisions were made, what decisions were made, so that we can learn for the future. Because I don't want us to repeat errors that we've made in the past. It's not about apportioning blame. It is about making sure that whatever we face in the next pandemic, we do so with our eyes wide open, equipped with that knowledge of prior learning, so that we do the very best we can.
I think in spirit of learning then from of decisions that were made and certainly mistakes that were made, do you think anything will be done internally in the party to investigate why your Welsh colleagues engaged in that policy when it was made very clear that from, you know, leaders of the party like Angela Rayner and Keir Starmer, that that's not what should have been done?
I mean, to be honest with you, the Welsh Labour Party is responsible for itself, just as, you know, I wouldn't want the Scottish Labour Party being commented on by our colleagues in Wales. I'm going to resist the temptation to do so. But what I say applies to all politicians, irrespective of political stripe, wherever they are in the country. Openness and transparency matters in politics. It matters to the people we serve, and it matters for future generations so that we learn. So whether it's WhatsApp or any other messaging platform, you know, if you're using it to make government decisions, and it's clear that the SNP were in Scotland, then that should be available and available for scrutiny. So my comments apply across the board.
We have a crazy week in politics recently, Jackie. You know, last week we talked a lot about off camera this the election of George Galloway and everything that's come with that by election, the Islamophobia row and the anti-Semitism row. What do you make of all this? How do you think your party dealt with that first and foremost, and what do you think the addition of George Galloway means for the chamber in Westminster?
Well, I think it will be disruptive. He is a disruptive influence, always has been. But the reality is, the more worrying thing for me is comments from Lee Anderson, from George Galloway at different ends of the spectrum, actually inflame the situation. You know, we have a huge spike in anti-Semitism. We equally have a huge spike in Islamophobia that has been since October of last year. So it's directly linked to the troubles that are out there. And we need to talk about it. You know, it's difficult conversations, but we need to confront it and we need to deal with it. What seems to be going on and what Rishi Sunak seems to be signalling is another culture war about the ability of people to protest. And to suggest it's simply Muslim people protesting, I think would be wrong. There are people of all different political persuasions, all different colours, all different religions, protesting what's going on in Gaza. But what I want is politicians that will bring people together, not set them apart. You know, it's not been that long ago that Jo Cox was murdered in her constituency. It's not been that long ago that another Tory MP, whose name escapes me, was equally, you know, murdered in his constituency. We need to stop violence, not just against elected members, but across our communities, and join together. And actually, we need to deal with the situation in Gaza. We've had no hesitation in Scottish Labour calling for an immediate ceasefire. You know, access to humanitarian aid going in, and a two-state solution. And no matter how much either Hamas or Benjamin Netanyahu don't want that two-state solution, that needs to be what we do in the future. And we need to stop that from feeding into Islamophobia and anti-Semitism.
Yeah, I think there was certainly a need for a strong diplomatic position by the UK. I didn't agree with people saying, "Oh, what can we do?" Because they might not cease fire anyway. But I don't agree with that. We're a permanent member of the UN Security Council. We've got huge influence in international affairs and diplomacy. What did you make of admitting holding Israel accounts to some of the alleged war crimes that they've committed over the past 4 months in Labour's proposal in Westminster?
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to hold both sides to account for what they did. On October the 7th, the horrific scenes of hostages being taken, people being killed, young women being raped. That is just as horrifying for me as some of the things going on in Gaza at the moment, and what some of the Israeli forces are alleged to have done. You know, we need diplomacy. We don't need any more violence and any more fighting. There needs to be an immediate ceasefire. And for goodness sake, you know, there were 2.2 million people in Gaza, many of them now crammed into a small area in Rafah, without food, without enough water, without enough fuel. It needs to stop. That kind of collective punishment of Palestinian people who live in Gaza just needs to stop. And so I hope the diplomatic community will make sure that they bring both sides around the table.
Well, we're going to finish on a lighter note, Jackie, because we've actually had a last-minute question come in, and it was, ask Jackie an old-school snog, marry, avoid question from the Untribal podcast. So I've been thinking, just as you were speaking there, who I'm going to mention here. So I'm going to say, you're familiar with snog, marry, avoid, aren't you?
No, say that again.
Snog, marry, avoid, you're familiar
oh,
with
yes,
this game?
Oh, yes, that, okay. Oh God, you're not going to do that to me.
I am, unfortunately. after speaking to the Untribal listeners, this is what I do. So I'm gonna go for leaders of the Scottish Parliament. I'm gonna go for Hamza Youssef, Douglas Ross, and Alex Cole-Hamilton.
Oh God, none of them. None of them. For God's sake, you need to at least give me a half decent choice. Right?
None of them. You don't get on with all of them, though.
Oh no, I get on with them, but I wouldn't snog marry them. Snog or marry them.
You wouldn't marry any of them. Not at
I probably
all.
Would avoid them all, given half a chance. That's an unfair question.
Yeah, it's unfair. Who'd you get on with best in the parliament, Jackie? Who's your pals?
So amongst the leaders, Alex Cole-Hamilton.
Okay. Yeah?
Amongst the leaders, and he and I will have some friendly banter from time to time. I think that's because we both served on parliamentary committees together. Okay. So got to know each other that way. But there's lots of them I get on with. And that's the thing about politics, is people see when you're arguing with each other, when you're being robust with each other. What they don't see is the friendship based on shared experiences, you know, the care for each other that there is that goes on cross-party. And long may that continue.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you mentioned that, because what I've seen, I mean, maybe it was the topic of Israel and Gaza and how sensitive it is and how emotions certainly flared last week in the chamber. But what a lot of commentators saw was a lot of hatred between Labour and the SNP. And do you think that speaks to what your relationship is like with your colleagues in the ELO, or do you think that speaks to how highly emotive a conversation that is?
I think my regret about what happened the other week, and I was down in London at the time, purely
coincidentally. It was 2 weeks ago, wasn't it? Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, it was 2 weeks ago. My upset was that actually we focused on internal processes and fighting each other when there was a much bigger issue that we were all debating, and that kind of got lost, you know? So that was my regret. I hate is a really strong emotion. I don't hate any of my colleagues. There are some that I would probably avoid, okay?
Who?
Because then I'm not telling you, because they're not.
Oh, no, come on.
Right? But seriously, you know, we make friends across party boundaries. We have understandings of what each of us is going through, because, you know, they went through the same thing as I'm going through as politicians. So we need to be just more respectful of each other. But actually, sometimes you get a lot of heat, not a lot of light. And the people we let down in doing that are our constituents. So whilst I might be robust in the chamber, I always look for the areas that we can compromise, we can work together, because I want to do the best for my area too.
Jackie Bailey, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on this morning. Is there anything you would like to say to our listeners before you go?
Nope. Have a great, looks like the weather's changing. I think spring has come. Let's hope there's a general election in May so we can boot the Tories out.
See you later, Jackie. Bye.
See you. Bye-bye.